Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled American Society is Built on Diner Booth by Joe Quinan. Then Jill Bogoski wrote, Am I struggling over my mother's Alzheimer's more than she is? Brenda Cronin's article is, In closure, may I say that been a minute is legend. Joseph Epstein wrote, Protest is not what it used to be. And then we'll follow that up with an article by Jim Solich, Colonoscopy Prep is Worse Than IKEA. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, American Society is Built on Diner Booths. Once upon a time, there was an old-fashioned diner-style restaurant in my town, and I frequented it for decades. A sizable group of us even had a breakfast club there, convening every morning to discuss ways the world could be improved. After my kids grew up and moved away, the first thing they wanted to do each time they came home was have pancakes in the mythical establishment they had cherished since they were toddlers. Locals loved everything about the restaurant, the ambience, the decor, the clientele, the staff. Most of us even liked the food, though generally speaking, the food was an afterthought. The restaurant, the original owner hated it when anyone referred to it as a diner, was a central meeting place in the village, the suburban equivalent of the ancient Roman Forum. It was like Cheers without the liquor. But after COVID hit, new owners remodeled the place, sprucing it up and giving it a glitzy new feel. They started by tearing out all the booths. I immediately stopped going. So did my friends and a lot of the old patrons. The breakfast club was kaput. Without our beloved booths, we were nothing. To my way of thinking, and I know I am not alone here, tearing out booths is woefully misguided. Americans love and revere booths. Booths let us be by ourselves while sharing a room with others. They allow us to immediately feel at home when we arrive in a town we have never visited before. Booths are a sanctuary, a haven, an island of tranquility in a sea of unpleasantness. It is not going too far to say that booths may be the one thing left uniting Americans through thick and thin. This is partly because they evoke an earlier, simpler time, but they are also the linchpin of the American movable feast. When my wife and I drove across the Midwest to Colorado Springs every summer, we know that there is a cozy booth waiting for us in the rib joint in Dayton, Ohio, and then a similarly comfy booth in the Chinese restaurant in Fulton, Missouri. There is a booth in the hotel in Topeka, Kansas, in the saloon in Hayes, Kansas, further down I-70, and finally an hour outside Colorado Springs, in the little German bakery in Victor, Colorado. There are even beckoning booths in the three-story pizzeria along the way in Abilene, Kansas, right around the corner from the Dwight D. Eisenhower Museum. Well, I would like to think that Ike himself ate there. Remember, Eisenhower served two terms in the 1950s when Detroit was making Thunderbirds and booths were all at their apogee. Other societies just don't seem to go in for booths like we do. I know the English don't, neither do the Swedes or the Spaniards. I do not remember seeing many booths in Toledo. Ohio, yes. Spain, no. True, the French have baguettes, but only a rank amateur would confuse a banquet with a booth. A banquet is a booth that has taken on airs and sneers at the hoi polloi. The fussy word banquet does not say, come on in, make yourself at home. the unpretentious word booth does. Unlike trattorias or brasserie, eateries with booth make you feel wanted. Everywhere I go, I seek out booths. At Mel's Diner on the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles, at Viand on Madison Avenue in New York, home to the rare two-seat micro booth, at the Quaker Diner in Philly. To be honest, I don't care about the food. I only care about the seating. The booth is the secret strength of this great nation, a time-honored institution that helps us survive the worst of times. And don't even get me started on lunch counters. And now, am I struggling over my mother's Alzheimer's more than she is? Entering the nursing home unit where my mother now lives is like entering a painting by Blake or Goya. Residents are hunched over their chairs, their ghostly heads down and mouths hanging open. Some wear mitten-like slippers, but my mother refuses them. Dignity is still important to her. My mother, Iris, is here because she is in the last stages of Alzheimer's. My sisters and I trade off seeing her as much as possible because we know that, even in her diminished state, she lives for our visits. I spot her bent over in a wheelchair and staring into space. My sisters and I approach her. "Hi, Mom," we say. She perks up as if the lights have been turned on in a dark theater. "Julie, Dee Dee, Laura," she says, her pet names for us. Tears sting my eyes. Our mother remembers us. "I'm so glad you're here," she says. My mother's slow decline was hard to witness. One day she could solve a crossword puzzle. The next, the letters did not form words. I think about how it must have felt when she first forgot how to get home from the grocery store or had to write post-it notes everywhere to remember her doctor's appointments. How did my mother's life come to this? Yet I sometimes wonder if I'm suffering over the loss of my mother's cognition more than she is. Perhaps we make too much of memory if someone's spirit is constant. John Bailey, in his memoir, Eulogy for Iris, about his wife, the novelist Iris Murdoch, and her dementia, writes that even with the disease, so much of her remained the same. Her presence seems as it always was and as it always should be, he wrote. I know she must have once been different, but I have no true memory of a different person. I know my mother can still take in the beauty of a flower, the face of a loved one, the sound of words. Movies seem to bring her back to herself. She laughs at A Fish Called Wanda, tears up at The Notebook. I'm not sure she can follow the stories in books and films, but I still sometimes read her a poem or passage from a book I'm enjoying when I visit. She always wants the same color of nail polish I'm wearing, so I try to remember to bring a bottle to paint her nails. She is still here, still alive. We push her back to her room. "Why am I here? What is happening?" she asks. I remind her that this is her new room, and she relaxes. I'm startled by the gray color of Mom's skin and her cadaverous eyes. She has sunk into herself, grown inward. Yet when she smiles, I can still see the mother I grew up with, who offered kind words like she was rich with them, who took care of her friends and our friends too. We are reassured when she asks for the cord of her room's lamp to be discreetly tucked away, as if she is still the perfectionist dinner party host, hand drying each lettuce leaf with a paper towel. No condiment bottles on the table. Never paper napkins. There is a screamer in one room on Mom's new floor and a wailer in another. This is something we must get used to. The aide neglected to put on Mom's bra, so her bosom has fallen to her belly. My poor mother, who always looked years younger than her age, derived such pleasure from her appearance. She wore a bra to bed to keep her breasts from sagging and slept with a satin pillowcase to keep her skin smooth and her hair styled. I write notes for the social worker. Make sure she has a bra when she is dressed. I wonder if the need for Mom to wear a bra be nightly dread that this stage of her illness is more for me than for her. Then I admonished myself. Of course my mother would want to look her best. Alzheimer's is a heartbreaking disease. Life constricts rather than expands. Sufferers often lose the ability to communicate pain. They need help for even the most basic care, such as bathing and getting dressed. Still, I count on her smile when she first sees me, the little tap of her hand. Her face still brightens when we tell her stories about her grandsons or flip through old scrapbooks together. Not long ago, when she could still speak at length, she usually couldn't recall what she had for breakfast, but she knew that the torn ticket from the 1951 Cleveland Indians games was from the first date she went on with my father. We wheel our mother out for a stroll. We stop by the main room, where a spry activity coordinator in a green uniform sings familiar songs for wheelchair-bound residents. Singing in the rain, "You Are My Sunshine," "Moon River." A few perk up and join in, others stare in bewilderment. Mom refuses to participate. She has led a long and complex life, and she remains alert to anything that feels infantilizing. With an eye roll, she expresses embarrassment, though perhaps this shame is because her daughters are here too. With a wave of her hand, she gets us to take her back to her room. We put a soccer game on our TV. Mom gives it a blank, expressionless stare, her eyes barely blinking. Bailey described its look as neither tragic nor comic. It indicates only an absence. It is, in the most literal sense, a mask. The clinical term for this is reduced gaze, a dementia symptom that inhibits typical eye movement, makes patients look like they are staring. I try to perceive my mother beneath this mask. I wonder where her mind goes when she drifts. Maybe she's dreaming or quietly observing her daughter's care. Maybe she's reuniting with my father, who's been gone a long time. Maybe this is okay, I think. Maybe it is time for mom to simply rest. There's a comfort to believe her essential self is intact. Although people with dementia may have lost the ability to tell a story about their life, they are still able to express this story in their behavior, writes Fabian Huttmacher, a psychology professor at the University of Würzburg. My mother may not remember the day or the time, but she is here. In her sunken brown eyes, I can see the woman I knew, the girl who was 8 when she lost her own mother, then went on to take care of the aunts who helped raise her, the single mother who raised 4 daughters on her own and soldiered on after burying one of them, the woman who wore a bikini on her honeymoon with her second husband, then divorced him when she found out 3 years later that he betrayed her. I see the mother who spent weeks making all the hors d'oeuvres for my sister's wedding, storing them in the freezer in anticipation. I rub her arm. I give her a sip of her Ensure. I hug her, though she can't hug back. Her mind, with a few words to express itself, is largely unavailable to us. Yet her soul, if the soul is the essence of a person, is for now forging on. And in closure, may I say that "been a minute" is legend. Language evolves, but sometimes it devolves. I long ago threw in the towel on closure. The pandemic saw school closings, not closures. Closure is even worse to describe solace or resolution of sorrow or mourning. Distorting nouns into frankenverbs, think prioritize and impact, has been going on for years, but still great. A recent addition is gift. He gifted me a new tennis racket. That should be gave. Another perfectly fine noun that has gone wrong as a verb is source. Blame food and fashion for calamities like the restaurant sources its troubles in Perigord and the designer sources his or silk in the Himalayas. What's wrong with finds, buys, or gets? Fashion also is the culprit for tacking on wear or wear when lazily groping for a good collective noun. Spectacles and sunglasses are eyewear, and salad plates and soup bowls are tableware. Cutlery is flatware, and everything from goblets to vases is glassware. When Skechers, which makes shoes for pretty much all ages, recently announced new ownership, new stories flowed that the shoewear brand was being acquired. Not every such change is a turn for the worse. I can see the sense in skincare and hair care. I can even abide the aspirational omnibus beauty rubric, which seems to encompass any potion, product, or process to improve one's appearance. But wellness and pretty much everything associated with it, self-care, journaling, mindfulness, negativity, should all be dispatched on a permanent spa retreat. As I write this, I've just received an email reading in part, "Life is busy and it's not always easy to prioritize self-care." That coined distressing sentence alone has my cortisol level soaring. And a plight aside to television talking heads, enough with own goal. It seemed fresh when applied to President Trump's tariff, but in weeks it cycled into an inapt and uninspired term, then a tired refrain. Lest I be tarred, can one write that anymore? As a grumpy old fossil, let me cite some pleasing developments. I would never use these expressions, but silently cheer when young people praise anything, a video, an Uncrustable, a restaurant, as fire or stick. I adore their conclusion in reducing goodness. I can't imagine how many years have passed since I last saw you, too. Been a minute. I recently asked a teenager about the chicken at a newly opened quick-serve restaurant, places we used to call fast food joints. He thought a moment and offered the priceless, solemn assessment. Legend. And now protest is not what it used to be. The campus protests of the late 1960s and early 1970s, known in one of my favorite euphemisms as student unrest, were different from those of today. Anger about the Vietnam War was at their core. The stakes were personal. If the war did not stop, many of the student protesters would themselves have to fight in it. Notice that the protests pretty much dried up once the protesters' butts were no longer on the line. Today's protests have an abstract quality. Most of those wearing kayakias and chanting against genocide in Gaza are not Palestinians. They are trying to express their hatred of Israel and, by extension, of America. That Hamas slaughtered some 1,200 Jews, many women and children among them, does not put them off. There is a vicious yet hollow quality about these protests, which are unapologetic in their anti-Semitism and defiant in their bias against the West. But then protest in America generally seems to have lost its moral authority. Recent Black Lives Matter stage protests on the fifth anniversary of the death of George Floyd. They seemed without impetus, a mere going through the motions, laboring as they did the progress that has been made by African Americans. Today, the three largest American cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, have Black mayors. States have elected Black governors and lieutenant governors. The racial makeup of Congress roughly mirrors the nation as a whole. Earlier Black protests had a moral vigor that had gone missing. Civil rights leaders of an earlier day, Martin Luther King, Whitney Young, A. Philip Randolph, Roy Wilkins, Bayard Rustin, had a gravitas that contemporary Black leaders lack. The appeal of earlier civil rights leaders was to conscience. That of today's leaders is to guilt, which is quite different. Al Sharpton is known for his attempts to strike a moral tone, but finally seems fit only to preach on weight loss and overdressing. Protests have long been part of American life. They began with those of suffragists seeking the vote and labor unions seeking collective bargaining, both legitimately good causes. The First Amendment guarantees the right of people to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But that assembly needs to be nonviolent towards both property and other people, and the grievances genuine. So many protests of recent years satisfy neither criterion. The destruction of personal and governmental property in Minneapolis and Seattle after the death of Floyd was not constitutionally protected speech. Neither is the continuing mistreatment of Jewish students at Columbia, Harvard, DePaul, and other universities. All they are is vicious behavior. Ours is in an age of high moral dungeon. Young people especially take serious offense at every opportunity. What else could it be that allows segments of the nation to feel they can righteously harass Jews, murder people on big city streets, condemn democratic nations, endorse terrorists, and empathize with killers like Luigi Mangione? Whatever it is, so long as it continues, the country will know no contentment, but will exist in a sad state of perpetual agitation. We do have one more. Colonoscopy prep is worse than IKEA. I'm on day 3 of my colonoscopy preparation. You read that right. Day 3. Had this been knee surgery, I would have been in and out the same day. This is a routine colonoscopy, the kind you're supposed to get every 10 years. Last time, the preparation was minimal. Start drinking a gallon of laxative solution at 6 p.m. the night before the surgery and try to finish it within 2 hours. This time the process had more instructions than an IKEA desk. I was told that 3 days before the procedure, I should follow a fiber-free, dairy-free, nut-free diet. After 2 days of that, I had to shift to a clear liquid gel diet. No smoothies, no soups, no fun. But wait, there's more. I was instructed to drink half the gallon of laxative sludge at 6 p.m. and then set an alarm for 2 a.m. to drink the other half. Are you kidding? When the nurse told me all this over the phone, I said, "You are aware that the night before open heart surgery, your only prep instructions are not to eat or drink after midnight, right?" There are now several easier ways to have your colon screened for cancer. The Food and Drug Administration recently approved a couple of blood tests, and there are self-administered stool tests. None require preparation. The problem, as your gastroenterologist will tell you, is that the no-hassle tests aren't as effective. Colonoscopy remains the gold standard. But 33% of American adults avoid or delay colonoscopies, according to a 2019 Harris poll. The main reason, the unpleasant preparation. Some will say we should just suck it up or down, but to be human is to put off difficulties or unpleasantness. Besides, medical procedures should get easier, not harder over time. When I had a hernia surgically repaired in 1977 at age 19, I was in the hospital for 4 days and I left with a 4-inch scar. Now it's an outpatient procedure. That's the type of progress we expect. If the colonoscopy is the gold standard of screening, medical scientists should find a way to make their preparation easier. What if they replaced the laxative solution with a delicious chocolate cake that achieved the same purpose? Or invented a camera probe powerful enough to see through the muck? This isn't out of reach. There's already a telescope that can see galaxies more than 13 billion light years away. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related death in the United States. 1 in every 5 people diagnosed with colon cancer are under 55, according to the American Cancer Society. The organization also recommends that people begin having colonoscopies at 45. Those folks aren't going to put up with colonoscopy prep that takes 4 days. They don't remember a word where you had to wait for photos to be developed. So please, dear medical research community, find a way to make colonoscopy preparation less awful. Our children's lives depend on us. And that brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I'll be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.